So it's John 13, starting at verse 31, which you can find on page 900. John 13, starting at 31. When Judas had gone out, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and glorify him at once. Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me, and just as I said to the Jews, so I now also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus answered him, "Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterwards." Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay my life down for you." Jesus answered, "You will lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the cock will not crow till you have denied me three times." This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you, Becky. Good evening. As Nigel said, there's some funny ideas about love out there, aren't there? Some people say love is all around. Some confess, "I want to know what love is." Some are more interested in metrics and reckon that there are different deepnesses of love. How deep is your love? Some are more optimistic. Love will find a way. Some are just awestruck. Love is a many splendid thing. But also it's a crazy little thing. And do you know there's such thing as a groovy kind of love? Well, now that I've put some terrible love songs in your head, we're going to think about the serious business of love, what it means for the Christian to love. And especially what it means for the Christian to love their brother and sister. What it means for you to love the person that sits next to you each week in church, or in front of or behind you, or who sits with you in a small group or a home group. Why do we need to work on this? Why is this such a problem? Well, it's true, it doesn't come naturally, does it? It's difficult enough amongst people who we live with, people that we might say, "Oh yes, we love them, they're our spouse or our children." Why should it be easier with those that we wouldn't normally associate with? Those that we're kind of thrown together with randomly in church. Because that's what church is like, isn't it? We're thrown together with people who are strange. God saves strange people. And if there are no strange people around you, the bad news is that you're the strange one. Well, that's the church, isn't it? That's what we're signed up for. And we'll see this evening that love is the distinguishing mark of the Christian, God's people. And it's not something, it's clear, that we can duck. The verse at the heart of today's passage, verse 34, makes that abundantly clear. Because Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another." It's not advice. It's not a nice to have. It's not an option. It's a commandment. Love one another. So we need to ask what Christian love looks like and how we can do it in difficult circumstances. And the good news is we don't have to guess. We have God's word as a resource for us. And we have the Lord Jesus here in this passage showing us. And so we'll see two things this evening. Where we get the pattern for our love for each other. And where we get the power for our love for each other. Together, they will make the impossible possible. To love the strange people that God has saved. So firstly, the pattern. Well, the pattern is there in the early verses of this chapter, chapter 13. And I know we looked at them even again this morning. But we looked at them certainly a couple of weeks ago in the evening service. Remember that the disciples and Jesus are here at the Passover meal. The tradition of the Passover had been in existence for centuries. It went way back to Exodus 12. The people of God had been given very specific instructions about how that Passover meal was to be eaten. They were to eat the meal with the belts tied around their waist and with sandals on their feet. They were to be ready to leave Egypt at a moment's notice to receive the rescue, the salvation that God was offering them. They have always then been a people ready to run at the time of the Passover. And then what happens? Suddenly Jesus gets up. He loosens his belt. He gets down on his knees and he takes the sandals off the disciples' feet, and starts to wash them. They must have been gobsmacked. They've stopped chewing at that moment, wondering what's going on. They can hardly believe it. It's clear that something new is happening right there. In place of the Passover, the pattern that they've been given is a pattern of love for each other. There's no need to be ready to run anymore. The commemoration of the Passover will be replaced with the commemoration of the Lord's Supper. A man with his friends saying, "Do this in remembrance of me." It's a new rescue, a new salvation. And so, later in the meal, in verse 34, when Jesus says, "Love one another just as I have loved you," they don't have to imagine what kind of love that is, how that looks. They've seen how Jesus has done it. They have got a pattern. They've seen that Christian love at work, in the church, means setting aside status and rank. Jesus has himself taken the form of a servant. He has set an example of what love is. Looks like. So let me ask frankly, do you think, have you got into the habit of thinking that you deserve to be served in this church? It's a hard thing to hear that, isn't it? Because this church needs desperate, simple acts of service of the kind that Thane was talking about earlier to work. If you're an older person who's lived a full life, is now enjoying their retirement, do you think you're entitled to some rest, to some honour? Do you think it's about time you were served? That you're special? Well, Jesus gives you a pattern. If you're leading a family, raising the next generation, taking them from this club to that event to the other meeting, the relentless busyness of a working week, do you think you're entitled to be served? Do you think that you're special? Jesus has given you a pattern. If you run your own business, employ many people, support many families, perhaps you've won an OBE for services to industry, do you think you're entitled to be served, that you're special? Jesus has given you a pattern. And if you're a young person, a person who is weighed down by expectation, by the weight of exams coming up, the next generation you are that will power the world with your creativity, Do you think you're special? Jesus gives you a pattern. I'm included in that. All of us are included in some way. All of us are inclined at some point to think that we are special, that our rank or our status or our honour makes us stand out. No, Christian love in this church ought to follow the pattern of Christ. It must be shocking, and it must be countercultural. Look at verse 35 with me. Because Jesus says, "By this, everyone, all people, will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." That love, it will be seen in the highest ranking, most decorated, wisest, cleverest, richest of us, setting aside all of that honour to serve one another, to love one another. And it will mean doing the most mundane, practical things that are offered for our brothers and sisters. Washing feet is not glamorous. Tidying the church is not glamorous. Making coffee is not glamorous. Leading a home group, that's not particularly glamorous. Even writing a check, giving money, is not glamorous. Driving folks to hospital is not glamorous. But Jesus is saying, he's saying that when these things are done by the wealthy widow, when they are done by the successful businessman, the company director, or when they're done by the intelligent teenager or the busy mother, that will be a glorious love at work. And that will startle the world. It will be like a beacon shining out to the whole society around. Jesus has given us a pattern woven with two threads, threads of status set aside and of simple helps for others. Love one another just as I have loved you. It's a commandment. But didn't you notice that Jesus says it is a new commandment? A new commandment. Now you might have thought that was odd, because the people of God have been commanded to love right from the earliest times. In Leviticus 19, they were told, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Yet there was always something legalistic about that command. It's why Jesus contextualizes it, explains it in Matthew's gospel. Because like all the Old Testament laws, it is easily read as a dutiful response to something, just something that you have to do because you are part of God's people. They are told again and again, the people of God, that they are above all to love the Lord your God. In a sense, the Old Testament emphasis is on love as a characteristic of the whole people, and not so much, at least, on love as a fruit of the individual Christian person's religious life. Now, all of that changes in the New Testament, because love runs like a golden thread all the way through the New Testament apostles' teaching, and especially brotherly love, above all. Love between those of the household of faith. And so Paul can write in Romans 12, "Let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection." And then in a phrase which could serve as a summary of John 13, he says, "Outdo one another in showing honor." Outdo one another in showing honor. And when I was a young Christian, I was wisely counseled by an older Christian that I was too competitive. I mean, I just felt like a typical teenager doing every sport that was available. But he saw the problem in that could be something that was destructive, taken to an extreme. But look at what Paul's saying here. Outdo one another in showing honor. We are to be competitive in one thing as Christians. That is, in showing honor, in humility. The startling truth of Christian love is that we are to fight to show honor to others, to raise their status, to make them feel comfortable, to give them our time, to serve them humbly. There ought to be almost a kind of unseemly rush towards helping people, our brothers and sisters, to honour them with our help. So what do you need to change this week to make you more competitive in this race? Well, something changes after Jesus between the Old Testament and the New Testament because, as I say, love for God's people becomes a building block of the new community, the church. But did you hear Paul say that the love that needs to be present needs to be genuine? Genuine was the word that Paul used. Now, I reckon this is probably the main problem for most of us. It certainly is for me, showing genuine love. There's nothing wrong with good habits, doing things on a rota, doing things because you've done them for many years and they've been a great help to the church. But we can, can't we, become dutiful in what we do. Just dutiful. We can go through the motions with what we do in church. We can look like we care, but really in our hearts, there's a resentment building up to what we're doing. Why do I have to be the one who's doing this? Why can't somebody else volunteer for a change? I suppose I'll have to do it again. Well, of course, I can give you £100. Here's the check. She doesn't deserve my help, not really. These are the kind of thoughts that can build up. How do we overcome it? How do we do these good deeds out of genuine love for others? Well, we can't manufacture it, that's for certain. Well, let's look at the other parts of the passage because there is some help there. Because Jesus, in giving this new commandment in verses 34 and 35, it's set within a context. A context for this new commandment for a new community. Remember, they're having a meal. Matt described that very vividly for us last week, didn't he? This meal has come to an abrupt standstill. Judas has been exposed as the betrayer. And like a key turning in one of those elaborate iron locks with gears and cogs and levers, something vast and cosmic is set in motion. And thereafter, events move tremendously quickly. We read verse 30. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he, that is Judas, immediately went out, and it was night. And verse 31 quickly follows. Jesus, remember, now has a room full of true disciples. And he can then begin what will become a major block of teaching through to chapter 17 of John's Gospel. So when he, Judas, had gone out, verse 31, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified." I wonder if you were surprised by that phrase. If the disciples were shocked, and they would have been because they'd just seen Jesus washing Judas' feet, none of this was a surprise to Jesus. He made the lock that the key fitted. Yet he says, "Now, now is the Son of Man glorified." Why? Why? Well, with the ejection of Judas out into the night, a chain of events that will lead to Jesus' crucifixion, death, and burial are set in motion. But they are a chain of events that will also lead to the resurrection, ascension, and enthronement of Jesus, the glorification of the Son, and the glorification of the Father through the Son. And they will happen, verse 32, at once, inexorably, immediately, now. That precedes his teaching on the new commandment. But then notice too that Jesus follows this commandment in verse 34 and 35 with an exchange with Simon Peter. It's another one of these very human exchanges that we get throughout the Gospels that almost put us in the picture. We can imagine being there. Because Peter says, verse 36, "Lord, where are you going?" Now, I don't know about you, but it reads as though Peter has heard what Jesus said at the end of verse 33, "Where I am going, you cannot come." And then tuned out for the important bit about love in the middle. Well, Jesus patiently replies that Simon Peter cannot follow him yet. And the reason why he cannot follow him will become very clear in verse 38. He will soon deny Jesus, too soon. And he will do that three times. He doesn't have, Peter, what it takes to suffer and to die with Jesus, to follow him. But the clear implication is that Peter will be able to follow Jesus eventually, because at the end of verse 36, Jesus says, you will follow me afterward. So this impossible, glorious love that we are to show to those in the church, genuine love, is possible. That will be true for Peter. And it's true for us as a church, because it is literally empowered by the glorification of the Son of Man. It's even more clear in chapter 15 when Jesus echoes this love teaching of chapter 13, making a connection between the love of his disciples and his own sacrifice even more explicit. So he repeats the words in chapter 15, verse 12. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. The same words. But then, greater love has no one than this. And he lays down his life for his friends. Well, like relay runners, the New Testament writers pick up this baton and run with it. Consider what the Apostle John wrote after he wrote this gospel in his first letter. He writes, "By this we know love, that Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers." Or Paul in Ephesians 5, "And walk in love, as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." There are many other examples spread all the way through the New Testament. God, time and again, is seen as the source of all love. And God's love in Christ is the source of all genuine love between Christians in the church. The definition of that love is both clear and astonishing. As I have loved you. It is sacrificial to the utmost. This week I was reading in passing a section from the book of Daniel. An angel, a messenger, appears to Daniel. And he begins his message to Daniel with this phrase, "Man, you are greatly loved. Man, you are greatly loved." And that is exactly how the gospel of Jesus Christ begins. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. And when we feel, when we profoundly, deeply feel in our hearts, so that we are moved inwardly, so that perhaps tears well up, we are taken out of ourselves, we are changed by what we know and what we feel, the depths of the love that Jesus has for us. Something changes. We know that he died for us, for me. I'm greatly loved. You can't manufacture it. I can begin to love then, only then, without hypocrisy. Genuine love. Peter did follow Jesus. He went on, as we know, to build the church, and as tradition has it, die for it in the same way as Jesus. There is no other definition of love that matters, at least among the people of God. It is sacrificial and it is unconditional. My love cannot be noisy, a gong, a clanging cymbal, signaling my virtue to others in some way. My love cannot be impatient or unkind, irritable or resentful, self-serving or arrogant. Because, yes, 1 Corinthians 13, which will be heard throughout the land in wedding services, is not meant for newlyweds. It's meant for us. It's meant for the everyday church living everyday lives together. For you and I. Faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Well, in a sense, in chapter 13, we witness the birth of the church. It's born with a purification, the ejection of Judas. And chapters 13 to 17 that follow contain teaching on what love looks like in this new community of Christ that is emerging. And we'll see more of this in the weeks to come.